Don't blame me, I voted for Kodos. In honor of Captive State, what cinematic alien or fantasy society would you most like to live in?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm not nearly brave enough to join Starfleet, but being a human on Earth in the era of Star Trek seems great.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to lean more towards the sci-fi fantasy society I'd like to live in and say the Chappie-verse.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm not choosing the same thing as Katie Rich, but I do want to live in the Earth Warp Society, the first one that we see Zephyr and Cochrane in Star Trek First Contact.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and this is a really easy answer for me. I want to live and always have wanted to live in the future world of Cowboy Bebop.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 249 and 32/37. Dave, these fractions are really turning into tongue twisters.
We're almost to our quarter quell.
We're getting
haven't
there eventually.
Haven't missed it yet, though.
It's the week of Wednesday, March 13th, the day that in 1956, John Ford's The Searchers was released. Good movie.
Remember when we had an author on this podcast talk about the making of Searcher?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great episode. Was that the old podcast? Is that available?
Yeah, I do not remember that.
I don't remember that either.
Wow.
Let me check. I'll get back to you on that, Patches, while we see if we have any reviews.
I met
David,
someone at
do we
South
have any
by
reviews?
Who was demanding
we do.
Episodes. So there you go. Read them.
Well, is this the time?
This is the moment.
Yeah.
Okay. We have two reviews. Hey, Dave, have you contacted that guy who left us a review a couple weeks ago? And that's
I'm going to be on a phone call with him this Thursday.
Oh, excellent. Oh. So much more responsible than Patches.
What the hell?
Let's see. Movie Requiem says, a pop culture and film podcast that is far from the shallow now. It's been on my mind to write a review for a while now, but when I heard David say, in quotes, the Shallow performance is the single best thing I've ever seen on the Oscars, I knew the time had come because he was, all capital letters, absolutely goddamn right. This podcast is a treat, regardless of the topic, because the hosts have such a comfortable and witty repartee with each other, and each film review is interesting and thoughtful. You can tell they've been friends for a long time, and actually enjoy getting into pop culture trends, moments, and everything in between. I always learn a lot, and I'm entertained at the same time, and goodness, can you ask for anything more? From reviews, movies, to the recent fascinating discussion on Spielberg versus Netflix, and the I like how they put versus in quotation marks to imply that maybe this doesn't need to be a war after all, and the business interest therein, this podcast has it all. Come for the insights and the laughs, stay for the stellar music cues. Keep it up, y'all. Very helpful. A reminder to keep it up, y'all. Liz Anya says, oh, that's clever. Liz underscore Anya. It's like lasagna. And maybe if her name is Liz Anya, it's phenomenal. You want a review? You got a review. Lot of good segues. Spelled like the transportation device. And capitalized. Everything else is good too. But really, this is a great podcast for those who enjoy being immersed in the world of pop culture and film. David Ehrlich, I apologize if I misspelled that. She did. Maybe an acquired taste, but you'll come to appreciate him. All four hosts work together great. Evidence from the episodes we're on are... When one or more hosts are out and the remaining still work together, albeit with different and entertaining dynamics, in parentheses, the Dave Seven and Katie Rich episodes are always the most fun. Shout out to Patches as well. Always insightful. Plenty funny. Plus, he has a great name. Here is your review. Was this review helpful? Yes, it was a review, which we asked for. Thank you, Lasagna.
What was the last Dave and Katie episode? Wasn't it just me playing with your son?
That was definitely the best one, but that was like the experiential like radio drama of Charlie seeing a lightsaber.
Sounds like great radio.
Pretty good radio.
Keep leaving us reviews. We like them. Thank you. Matt Patches, I believe you went to South by Southwest. As a father now, did you have any fun or were you just tired the whole time?
Well, in theory, not being around my kid, I would not be as tired, you know, running around, and I could sleep in. But I didn't. I'm exhausted as hell. I'm actually, I realized South by, I haven't been in many, many years. I think the last time I was there, I was there with David, actually. And we, and seeing Bridesmaids. So that was in 2011. I have not been to this festival in many years. It kicked my ass.
Obviously you've changed and weakened, as your bones begin to
dramatically.
But has the festival changed in any significant way?
The festival has changed, but not in the film programming. If you don't know much about South by, it, unlike something like Sundance, where we're all there to see movies, it's around the clock. We start at like 8:30, 9 a.m., and we're watching movies until midnight. South by gets off to a slower start. The movies start around 11. They're kind of holding on to the big stuff until the end of the evening. So if people are going to work during the week, they can come see movies at night. But it's also a huge festival for tech people from San Francisco. There's an interactive portion, and there's all sorts of panels. And now,
do you have to be from San Francisco to participate in the
it seems
tech
like
portion?
You do. You could be from anywhere, of course, but a lot of people are coming to pray at the altar of SF Silicon Valley, you know, these gods. And there's a bazillion brand activations, and it's a circus, and it was more of a true festival, a true, just like every corner had someone building out a section of Austin for their own purposes. Vox, my company, did the exact same thing. They took over an event space, and we had a huge, like, offsite South by experience the whole time. So I actually ended up splitting my time between seeing some movies, and Polygon put up a really cool arcade, which was neat. And I hosted a panel, which I would direct people to. I won't go into it too much, but I think I teased it at the end of the previous week's episode, eons ago, whenever that was. I've lost my mind. But I had a great conversation with some Adi Shankar, who produces Castlevania on Netflix, among like Dread. He produced Dread, all sorts of movies. Had a great conversation with him and two people in games about the cinematic versus gaming language. And we really galaxy brained on that panel. I think we're going to put the audio up on.
Can we get that? Oh, yeah.
We're going to put that audio up on Polygon, the Polygon Show podcast feed for people who are going to look for that maybe in the next week or two. So I won't take us too far off track in describing that panel, but we go some crazy places. A really fun conversation about kind of Bandersnatch being the lowest common denominator in the blurring between games and movies, and it's going to get so much more interesting. And the people who, you know, this woman who directed Uncharted, the person who's overseeing all of the Halo games and Showtime's Halo show, these people were sitting on the panel talking, truly, truly galaxy braining.
Did you talk
on
to
this
the
idea.
People who directed Assassin's Creed Odyssey?
No, but you'll be happy to know that Adi Shankar is working on a Assassin's Creed, like, anime series similar to this Castlevania
show. I don't care about an Assassin's Creed.
You will.
The story is the dumbest part.
I know.
Skip,
I mean,
smash circle until those scenes are over.
So, I mean, this is the great question. Why would you make something out of a game like that? And if the story is the least fun part, and that's the great challenge. Anyway, getting far off track. You know, South by does still have its concentration on film. And if you're not, you know, you're dodging scooters on the way to movies now, that's the biggest change. I don't know.
I heard you were pro scooter.
I have become pro scooters. Just to debrief here, Austin has, how many other cities have done this? Did San Francisco do this too?
A lot of
LA.
Denver's 100% scooter now.
It's unreal. I mean,
New York hasn't done this, right?
No, New York could not do this because
it would be
they
a disaster,
are all over the streets, all over the sidewalks, and our streets are way too narrow for that. But yeah, you can now Uber, Lyft, and two other companies have scooters just all over the place, and you can pick them up, scan them, and be on your way. They're motorized scooters. And
did you use one?
I used one on the last day, and I will say I got to and fro pretty quickly, but it's not safe at all. And you just throw it
on
the ground.
Do you ride them on the sidewalk?
Later. Yeah, no, you're not allowed to ride them on the sidewalk. You ride them like you would a bike on the streets. And you're not wearing a helmet, and you're standing on this thin little board, motorized. It's insane. But it's also really quick, so there's that. Anyway, I did see some movies, and we should talk about it. I think David saw some movies that played at South by as well. You know, South by, I haven't been since 2011 because, it's a hard festival to pick up after Sundance. A lot of the stuff is held over from that festival. And some of the other movies are, you know, we talk about, oh, I hope things at Sundance get picked up so that these movies we're seeing, the movies we're talking about, everyone who listens to this podcast will be able to see them later. And more that's true because there's so many streaming options. There's so many distribution outlets at this point. It'll end up somewhere, whether or not it's easy to see. That's a different story. South by, it seems like there are truly movies that may never see the light of day. Just really tiny indie stuff. During my festival, because I was splitting my time so aggressively, I saw some of the bigger movies. I got to see Us, which I don't want to talk much about. I want to definitely talk about it with all of you. Jordan Peele's follow-up to Get Out, which I guess I went in, to be honest, with really low expectations. I don't know why. Why would I not give Jordan Peele the benefit of the doubt? Cause he's only made one movie. That's why. Sophomore slump. It happens. But Us is a real surprise. It's a real big movie. It's a real flex, if you will. So that's exciting.
It's funny to me that you would think you would have low expectations and not think it would be a flex when Get Out being his directorial debut was a gigantic flex.
Yeah. No, I guess I could see someone getting really caught up in the mythology of themselves, like Shyamalaning, if you will, instead of really growing and challenging oneself, because he's still working in the studio system. I don't know. There's a fear there. And he took on a bazillion projects after Get Out exploded. And this one feel, you know, you watch it and you're like, this man should make a Twilight Zone series. So it's very appropriate that he will be soon. We will loop back to that. There's so much to talk about in Us, which is the most exciting part. I don't even know if it all works and it all makes sense, but there's so much to talk about. David, what did you wind up seeing, since I'm monologuing about here? What did you see from Southwest?
They screened in New York Harmony Korine's new film, The Beach Bum, which I've had a hit and miss relationship with Harmony Korine. I was not expecting to be as enraptured by Spring Breakers as I was. Which is definitely, you know, him taking himself in a new direction. Miles, what's that?
Spring Break.
Feels like 10,000 years.
It was. That was in 2013, which may as well be 10,000 years ago. And I had very low expectations, like Patches with Us, for The Beach Bum, just because I had never really been on board the Harmony Korine train before. I am very happy to say that The Beach Bum, while not quite on par with Spring Breakers for me, is much closer than I ever thought it would be. It is hilarious. I'm still trying to work out what it is that it all means, but we are watching Matthew McConaughey in final boss mode. He has unveiled his true form. I don't understand what the point of him continuing his career from this point is. There is nowhere else for him to go. This is the movie that he was born to make and has been working towards. And when he finds out that he was in it, he is going to be delighted. I think that Martin Lawrence, so funny. I mean, The Beach Bum is essentially just a movie about James Franco's character from Spring Breakers, but much nicer and wild. And Matt McConaughey just plays a rich writer who is bouncing around Florida. He is the Florida man that you hear so much about. And his wife, Isla Fisher, their daughter's getting married, and he makes back home in time for their wedding, and then things go haywire from there, and it becomes a very episodic bounce around Florida that, in Harmony Korine's words, and I think that he nailed this benchmark, is only comprised of the good parts of a movie. It is one highlight, strung together with another as plotlessly as possible, even though the premise of the movie is basically Arthur, because at a certain point, Matthew McConaughey's character, Moondog, which of course is Matthew McConaughey's character's name, is told that he has to essentially write a book before he can inherit this shit ton of millions of dollars, that he doesn't really want. Patches, did you see this?
I did not. It was actually my competition, for my panel, unfortunately. So,
oh no.
Tough competition.
Well, it comes out.
I'll never see this. Yeah,
it comes out in like 2 weeks. It comes out on the 29th, but it is so funny. Martin Lawrence, who has not been in a movie in about 10 years, has like all the supporting characters in here is just in like a chunk of the movie, as Moondog moves from one character to the other. his part is probably twice as large as Zac Efron's. Zac Efron wears a pair of JNCO jeans. It's amazing. But
and
Martin
has hair
Lawrence,
inspired by a panini.
Yes, he does. Martin Lawrence, I don't even know where to begin. The man deserves several Oscars for this film. It's wonderful work. But yeah, I had a blast with this. I also saw a documentary about the late SoundCloud rapper Lil Peep, which I thought was interesting. It was executive produced by Terrence Malick, of all people. Not that
Wait,
his influences.
Really?
Yeah, because the guy, one of the two directors, was on the editorial team for Malick's last three movies. And so he got that blessing.
That
I wish
like
that,
terrible Mad Libs, Lil Peep and.
Yeah, yes. I do wish, like the way the movie opens, you think it's really going to be Malicky, and then it quickly moves into more conventional ground. But it's an interesting movie, about, you know, what fame looks like and how toxic it can be, in this day and age, the immediacy, the borderlessness of fame now. I mean, there's a scene where Lil Peep is in the studio recording a song and like tweeting out that it'll be available. He's dropping it in 15 minutes and he's still in the process of recording it. It's crazy. What else did I see? I saw, a Johnny Cash doc, which is fine. I saw, the directorial debut of Logan Marshall Green, who made a movie called Adopt a Highway, starring Ethan Hawke as an ex-con who discovers a baby in a dumpster a few days after he gets out of prison after like a 20-year stretch and is trying to take care of that baby without getting drawn up on kidnapping charges.
A Blumhouse picture.
You didn't see that one, huh?
No, I did not. I did not.
Yeah, you're not missing too much. It's pretty slight.
See, you know, to shout out my standouts of the fest, I didn't get to see Booksmart, Olivia Wilde's directorial debut. I'm sure we'll talk about that for a lot of time.
Does that have a distributor already?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Annapurna, I think, is putting that out. It's
coming out in May.
I think it's going to be huge. You know, people talking about it at the festival were like, this is
it's
a masterpiece.
It's going to single-handedly save Annapurna.
Superbad. You know, this is a big deal. So we'll talk about that when that comes out. But little movies that I wonder if they'll find a way, to your eyeballs, listeners. Bleecker Street is putting out a movie in June called The Art of Self-Defense. It's directed by Riley Stearns, who did a movie called Faults a few years ago. And this is such a peculiar movie. I don't really understand Bleecker Street's strategy as like a small time distributor. That was the conversation I had immediately with colleagues exiting this movie. Like, how does this movie connect with people? Why does this make sense in this business world that we live in? Maybe that's the wrong conversation. I'm glad it exists because it's a fucking riot. It stars Jesse Eisenberg as, you know, just a very insecure man, increasingly paranoid as he learns about the dangers of the street at night. He gets mugged. So what does he do? He takes self-defense classes. He goes to learn like judo. His sensei, played by Alessandro Nivola, is a complete misogynist asshole teaching him about masculinity. The movie's very much about toxic masculinity to extremes and like defining yourself based on the worst definitions of masculinity, fighting. The movie is like Yorgos Lanthimos does Fight Club, but with a jokey tone akin to Wet Hot American Summer, is how I've been trying to package it for people. It
sounds
is
great. I know that Riley worships the altar of Yorgos Lanthimos, so I'm not surprised. Yes.
I mean, the dialogue and the dialogue is the inspiration for that comparison, along with some of the like great camera work. And but it's really about heightening the environment from the very first seconds. Everything is absurd. Everything is intense. And he really takes a big swing. It's a hilarious movie. It's a frightening movie. And I hope people find it when it comes out in June. The other movie that really struck me, and then I walked out of the movie, and of course, half the people I saw it with hated it, apparently.
We have to clarify the rhetoric. People say walked out of the movie, and that explicitly means that you left before it was over. It's a pet peeve of mine. You have to say, like,
what are you supposed to say instead?
I don't know.
I exited the theater after the conclusion of the film.
Thank you.
Asshole.
just for the clarity's sake.
Everybody knows once the best boy credit comes up, it's okay to
leave. I didn't walk out. I exited the film at the a loud conclusion. The film I'm talking about is The Day Shall Come, Chris Morris's follow-up to his 2010 movie Four Lions. If you saw that, that movie was about like a bumbling crew of jihadists, and it pressed buttons. It was hilarious. I really liked
Four
Lions.
Fun fact, it's the only movie I've ever seen at South by Southwest because I happened to be in town for a wedding.
Really?
I saw Four Lions. Yep.
Did you like Four Lions? Do you recall?
I did.
Okay. So this movie,
it came out right after In the Loop, I think, and they kind of got twinned in my mind, and I loved In the Loop too.
This movie is more similar than I thought it would be. It is again about kind of domestic terrorism, or like on American soil terrorism. Chris Morris being a cheeky British comedic writer, director, looking at our world from the outside, which will rub people the wrong way a lot of the times. And during the Q&A of this film, even the actors, a majority of them who are black, were like, should I be doing this movie? And then having conversations with Chris Morris, were convinced like, yeah, this is going to be good. And I understand what we're doing here. And we're going to, again, push buttons. This film starts with a card that says based on 100 true stories. And Morris gave us a little background on what he means there. Basically, there are many, many incidents, and I'm not familiar with this, and I can't wait to dig up some information on this, but of the FBI basically convincing fringe groups, religious groups, people who could be easily stamped as terrorists in the right context, the FBI convincing them or entrapping them into committing acts of terrorism.
Yes, this is like the guy that gets too far in deep because he told some dude he'd get a hold of warheads, and then the next thing you know, the FBI is selling him warheads, and he goes to jail for buying warheads from the FBI.
You are describing the plot of this movie now.
Do you know this guy?
Yeah.
No, this actually happened. This does happen all the time.
Yeah, so the example Chris Morris used was apparently there were some guys in Florida who were convinced to tell informant agents or undercover agents that they were going to ride into Chicago and like destroy the Chrysler building on four horses. And that's how they got arrested and imprisoned for like 25 years. Just an absurd story. And so this film takes that same premise. Anna Kendrick and David O'Hare play FBI agents who are targeting it's kind of like a Muslim African-American. It's not even like Muslim. It's just this fringe religious group living on a farm, quote unquote, in Miami. And they're speaking to God and they're trying to make do. And they're like trying to pay the rent. And they're really good people. And every time the FBI tries to entrap them in a terrorist plot, they keep calling people out and turning those people into the FBI. So they keep getting caught in a loop. And it's very absurd. It's very silly. And then, of course, it's really frightening because it is based on truth and it's not going to pull any punches in the end. I thought it was a pretty jaw-dropping, often funny
movie. Anna Kendrick is in this somehow?
And Anna Kendrick is the FBI agent.
She's the FBI
agent.
She's
trying to pin crimes on people.
I was listening to synopsis.
Thank you, Dave.
I wasn't.
So, yeah, and it was hilarious. I don't know why anyone would ask this at a Q&A, but the South By moderator asked Chris Morris, the last question was like, where do you see this movie going or playing? and he was just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Why would you ask me that? And then followed it with like, who knows? You know, he has no idea if anyone's going to buy this movie or put it out. It's not easily packaged. It's not Good Boys, the movie I saw directly after it, which is basically super bad with 11-year-olds saying fuck and shit and like taking Molly accidentally. You know, the dumbest dumb shit that will get you to laugh. And maybe I don't actually know if anyone's going to see that movie when it eventually comes out. We were talking about before in the podcast. This movie comes out August 16th. It's written by Gene Stumsky and Lee Eisenberg, writers from The Office, produced by Seth Rogen. It is super bad with 11-year-olds. Jacob Tremblay is one of them. But like, what adult is going to pay to see an R-rated movie starring 11-year-olds swearing? Is that something that people want? Does that sound funny?
I thought, and I'm someone who is very susceptible to Seth Rogen's brand of comedy, and he, you know, is the sort of the grand doyen of this movie, and the trailer opens with a whole scene that they shot just for it of him telling the little kids who star in the movie that they're not old enough to see it. I thought the trailer was insufferable. I guess where my interest in Seth Rogen meets a wall is in little kids saying naughty words for 90 minutes. That just doesn't really do it for me. And I don't know. There are just so many other big comedies coming out of South By, including one starring Seth Rogen, The Long Shot, with Charlize Theron, which looks totally up my alley. And something like a backdoor entry of a big studio rom-com coming back. Yeah, I am really not looking forward to ever seeing this movie.
Well, Katie, you can take Charlie to it and teach him some bad words.
Mm-hmm. He probably would repeat them at this point, so be careful what you wish for.
Humble as leaf on the tree, the autumn took the rest, but they won't take.
Hey guys, guess what? There was a new Aladdin trailer. That means it's time for Fighting in the War Room to check in with Guy Ritchie's Aladdin.
I think this is the first time that we've had the full podcast for our either dunk or dissect on Aladdin segment.
For sure. This is the first time that Katie has been here for sure, because she watched the trailer right before this episode. This is the third trailer. This is the full trailer. This is the only one that gets some actual music played into it, which is super fun, as well as a montage of, you know, recognizable scenes. The live action version's going to have all your favorite stuff from the animated version. There's going to be a Do You Trust Me hand outreaching into a whole new world. There's going to be a Cave of Wonders. There's going to be basically all the same gags from Friend Like Me. As far as we know, probably not a really long.
Yeah, even the part where he like dresses him in clothes. There's that scene in the trailer where he has glasses on like he's some sort of designer and he's changing Aladdin's clothes. It's exactly the same movie, beat for beat. It's amazing.
There's going to be rapping this time.
Now with more rapping.
There is apparently going to be rapping. Yes. So we've been tracking this. Here's how the trailer things have gone so far. First trailer, we were like, what the hell? The design of Cave of Wonders is wrong. We're just watching a parrot fly over things. They must not be done making this movie. Second trailer, we got a little peek at Will Smith's genie. I did not like the Cave of Wonders design, nor the Will Smith design, and Patches filled us in that Guy Ritchie's ultimate goal was to make a muscular, powerful genie for some reason.
A big dad bod.
We're unable to determine.
Also, when you say we had a peek at Will Smith's little genie, I there's something really gross about that. Sorry. Let's move on.
Yeah, so now that we've got this full trailer and it actually looks like we're going to, you know, see an actual movie. This is the first trailer that looks like it's from a film that's actually close to being done. So congratulations, guys. You finally got there. What did we think about this Aladdin trailer? Let's start with Fresh Katie, who hasn't, you know, slammed this movie
DJ
before.
Fresh so. Katie?
DJ that's Fresh right. Katie.
I just, like, more so than even with Beauty and the Beast, which is a movie that I thought was fine and went to see and could live with, I don't understand why this exists. I don't see any single thing that can possibly be improved on the original by doing this, which, again, I don't think was true of Beauty and the Beast, but something about this one just feels like not just pointless, but, like, surreally pointless. Is that what you guys have been saying about this to the point that it's, like, almost, like, it's a bet they took of like whether or not they could like actually do it, and they did it, but it still just looks
you're hitting surreal. On why I think this will be better than The Lion King, because it it is passing a threshold of purposelessness to find new it is art by being completely devoid of art.
Wow.
The Lion King is like trying to be more of a movie, and this is I don't know, restaging. This is putting up your Broadway revival or something.
Well, this seems like, you know, The Lion King seems like it's going to be a real simulacrum of the animated movie that's really going to be, or the first animated movie, I should say, that's really just going to be sort of scene for scene. This looks like it will have its own Guy Ritchie flourishes, for worse or for worse. I mean, I'm torn because I'm appalled at the idea, the incredibly cynical idea to my mind of these movies just spiffing up Disney classics with less exciting, with less imagination altogether, really. But at the same time, I'm really nervous about anything Guy Ritchie is going to do to change this. So it's sort of a lose-lose.
Well, I thought what's surprising about the trailer is that the least successful part to me is that opening scene where he's doing the foot chase. Which should be Guy Ritchie's bread.
Because they speed ramp it?
Yeah, it should be his bread and butter, like making that work. And then the most exciting part is the glimpses of the big show tune numbers where you get the like floating master hand from Smash Brothers controlling Aladdin or whatever down the Cave of Wonders. Like that stuff looks kind of beautiful, or the Bollywood-esque big production on the, in the brightly lit full colors. I don't know. That kind of stuff looks pretty entertaining. I could kind of see why you would want to make this movie when you stage big production numbers like that. That is fun.
I'm into the color design. Here's what's bothering me now. Because can't give this movie a pass yet.
Or all ever.
Right, forget it. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see.
Although I had prejudged. I'm just to say quickly, I had prejudged a certain other Disney remake that is coming out soon. In that I was dreading to see it more than just about any other movie I could think of, and I saw it today. And
what could you possibly be talking about?
I don't know.
Don't be dumb.
Mystery, but I had a decent time with it. So you never know with these things. We all have our fears and assumptions going in, but once the lights go down, it's anyone's game. Dave, what were you saying? I'm sorry.
So Guy Ritchie, in terms of films of his that I like, it's a very kinetic director. If you go back through and watch the Aladdin trailer, there are like tilts, but the camera's basically locked off except for digital moves, which scares the shit out of me. Because that means somebody shot a plate and they're figuring out how the scene fits together, and that's not a Guy Ritchie directorial task that I think he's necessarily good at. So now what I'm concerned about is just looking at how it's shot, like he's going to shoot it like he's shooting a stage musical. And that would just lead further back, I think, into Katie's question, like, why? If you're going to do this, why not be distinctly something about it?
I mean, that is a choice, though. That staging old school movie musical dance and song numbers is a big choice, because the original movie's not like that. It's much more close-ups and springy animation, mostly derived from Robin Williams' Genie character. It's not like a Broadway musical. If you could do something that kind of throws back to
mostly out of
mid-20th century musicals, that's fun.
Some Raja erasure, I will not have okay. it.
And there's also a Big
he
Iago.
He expresses like a damn good tiger.
You didn't talk about Big Iago. Now there's going to be a big action
Big Iago.
Scene.
Yeah, there's a... They're adding stuff in because one of the things in the trailer you can see that is not in the movie is a giant parrot, who's a Alan Tudyk parrot, we learned today.
Jafar!
Yeah, except Alan it's going to sound like K2SO.
They really do.
But yeah, that's checking in with Aladdin. We probably won't have to check in with Aladdin again until May when it
we
comes
actually
out,
check it in.
God willing.
So just so I've got the right count, we've got this and Lion King and Dumbo all this year. Is that
Wait,
it?
No, there's a now. They just added one. Maleficent 2 is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
They're fully packing it in.
They moved it forward 6 months. It's just unheard of.
You got to wonder, what do you think that's about? That it's all the assets are there. They shot the footage. Let's have the biggest year of all time. And just stuff it into 2019. I mean, there's not that much on their calendar going forward.
Can we make $5.5 billion in
I mean, it
year?
Feels Let's like the out. Netflix model. It really feels like we need to be the only studio. We need to crush everything, make this the biggest year of all time, ultimate disruption for something
Great.
That's not a startup.
Great, we can have one streaming company and one theatrical company with their own streaming platform. And,
yep.
Can't go bad. Can't go wrong.
And then Bleecker Street putting out The Art of Self-Defense.
Also, Katie, we might get one more of these live-action, quote-unquote, remakes if the Lady and the Tramp movie comes out on Disney Plus before the end of the year.
It's the live-action part that's in quotes. The remakes thing, I think, is pretty unambiguous.
No, it's a remake. But, well, actually... Lady and the Tramp is live action because it's going to be one of these. They shot
There's actual
real people
humans in
and then
it. Yeah.
CG dogs. Yeah.
about Captain Marvel after it has come out, not only because we like to be able to talk about things with spoilers and allow everyone to see it, but I finally saw it. I went today to a screening at my local Alamo Draft House, where it was an Alamo for All event where I could bring my baby, who watched like half of the movie, which I was kind of frustrated by because I hope he'd sleep through the whole thing. So I saw Captain Marvel. I have sat out so much of the internet debate about this one, which was amazing. It's never be on Twitter. It's great not to see what everyone's yelling about. I'm aware that there are, typically a lot of like weird sexist dumb boy responses, and then also an idea of whether or not women have different responses to this. And you guys can probably fill in more on this. I thought it was fine. I realize I feel mostly the same about every Marvel movie, in which it's kind of hitting the things that I like in a Marvel movie. This one had a few more interesting things that I liked more. I liked the cat. I thought Ben Mendelsohn, who we can maybe talk about in more detail later, was great, like in a way that he hasn't been in a lot of villain roles in other big movies, and most villains in most Marvel movies aren't. I was really excited about that. I think Brie Larson maybe is not the best person to play this role, which also we can talk about. But mostly I thought it was fine. I see a Marvel movie, I enjoy it while I watch it, and then 5 hours later, I haven't thought about it and may never think about it again until I have to podcast about it. So I can't really muster like the huge, strong rally defenses feelings about this. And it's a shame we don't have Joanna Robinson on, because she is one of those big defenders. And I think it'd be really interesting to hear from her, but it's fine. It's another cog in the Marvel machine. I enjoy watching them.
Well, this,
can we move on?
Captain Marvel is my second favorite Marvel movie, I think. Maybe.
Whoa.
Whoa.
I'm ready to defend, but I want to put in
First Avenger.
That's correct.
You know,
correct.
I have been meaning to say, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, that the one silver lining of my Marvel marathon last year, other than the money it raised for Every Town, was a new appreciation for Captain America.
The First Avenger. Really, please use the
First
title.
Avenger.
Thank you.
The First Avenger. No, and I'm glad you asked me to specify, because I explicitly do not mean Captain America, Winter Soldier, or Captain America, Civil War.
I don't understand the love for Winter Soldier. I'm going to make my wife cringe by saying this right now, because she loves that movie.
Your wife. I mean, there are totally legitimate reasons, I'm sure, for loving it. My feeling at the time was that people were looking for a reason to, or any sort of scraps of evidence they could, to take their love for Marvel more seriously and sort of look at the series through a different lens.
It's a paranoid thriller.
It's like directed by Alan Pakula. It's like, no, it's not. It's bad. It's not nearly as bad as Civil War, which is one of the worst Marvel movies. But Captain America: The First Avenger is absolutely wonderful. And I will say that the final line of that movie is my single favorite moment in the entire MCU.
And I'm saying that Captain Marvel is right up there with
saying that you are crazy.
It might not be my number two. Maybe the Avengers is my number two.
I was going to say, I think the Avengers is the only Marvel movie I love. Like, I have genuine affection and would want to revisit frequently.
But I don't think,
and all of the others kind of fit in the mushy middle.
Have you revisited the Avengers recently?
Because
I think people love a big chunk of the Avengers, and maybe not the whole movie.
I remember the beginning where they turned Hawkeye into a zombie being pretty bad.
Yeah, the second half and the battle for New York, which Patches wrote an entire story about, is wonderful.
But thank you.
No.
Well, since we're here to talk about Captain Marvel, it probably says good things about the movie that we're talking about other Marvel movies.
Yeah, boy, does it ever.
I'm building up to why Captain Marvel gets things right that so many other movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe do not. And I guess it's a lot of what you're saying, Katie. There's twists. I think people were knocking this movie early on because the trailers felt really limp, and it didn't surprise, or I understood why after seeing the movie, because this whole thing's kind of predicated on revelations and reveals and twists, I think, is a kind of crass way of putting it. Spoilers is a crass way of putting it, because I think it's a good script. I think it does unpack a lot of mystery in this woman's life that is built from trauma. And if you talk about Brie Larson,
can I ask you a question about that?
Hold on. That if you're talking about Brie Larson not being good in this movie, I'd be curious how much of that has to do with the hurdles of this character, who only has backstory in like old photographs that she discovers on Earth, or she's wading through the murkiness of her own life. That's a hard thing to kind of deal with, and I think the movie doesn't do it perfectly, but that's part of the kind of exercise in dealing with trauma. I see a lot of connections between Carol Danvers and her character in Room.
Hmm.
Can I just ask a particular question about the way you were talking about the character's backstory? I felt that one of the movie's fatal flaws is the decision to, and this is hard for me to say because I've always sort of railed against Marvel's penchant for origin stories and how samey they can feel. But here is a movie where they tried to disguise the fact, like a Skrull, tried to disguise like a Skrull that this was an origin story by Call the Conqueror. They tried to disguise the fact this was an origin story by starting the movie with her already having her powers and just sort of sprinkling some flashbacks into how she got them over the course of the movie, making it a mystery. I think it is a absolutely fatal decision for this movie because it made it – I mean, not only are the first 20 minutes kind of incoherent, but it also really makes it impossible to get under the character's – or for me anyway, obviously not impossible. A lot of people love this movie, but difficult for me to get under the character's skin and appreciate her as anything more than a symbol of her own strength and sort of see her as the personification of some of the themes that she embodied. But it was really hard for me to find an actual character for Brie Larson to play. Did you feel like the screenplay, which you said that you loved, made a good choice in being structured the way that this is?
I agree that the first, like, 15 minutes are – I don't think they're messy. I just think they're kind of plodding in a weird way. They're just so slow. I wanted her to get back to Earth faster and not deal with so much of the cosmic Kree, Skrull, war stuff. I wish she didn't have to go. We should just fully talk about spoilers, I think, too, because I would not mind. I don't want to jump around, you know, plot points of worry.
No, I think waiting until the weekend after it opens makes spoilers.
Yes. Okay, great. All spoilers from here on. But, you know, she goes on this mission on some planet to rescue. All that stuff is, I know we need some action beats in this thing, but Captain Marvel's at its best when it's really like all the cosmic stuff happening in the background, and Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck get to make their little indie movie.
Yes.
A lot of
you mean the scenes that they actually directed and weren't pre-vised before they showed up?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, those are the good scenes.
I definitely thought about that so much, you know, that piece you were talking about with the Avengers. I had never heard anyone lay out, like some of the Marvel people that I talked to, just how involved everyone is in storyboards and how directors really just come in and approve storyboards. And I mean, it should be a collaborative process. You want to work with collaborators on that. And I do feel like they've stifled themselves with the previs, the third coast previs stuff and all the storyboarding. And here it's, you know, they definitely had certain action beats that they were going to execute from the beginning. I do think the end action stuff is a lot more successful because you can build it off of character development, but that early stuff is,
I mean, it's a bit they of a choose chore. Not to, but you could.
No, they do.
The end stuff, unlike most Marvel movies, is taking place mostly within a confined space. Like it's interactions between people and not giant ships hovering over a city, which I appreciated.
Yes.
Well, it's all takes place in a giant city. It all takes place in a giant ship that's hovering over Earth somewhere, but they don't.
Yeah, but there's not.
But on the inside,
there's no human city being threatened at any point.
I know what you
right,
mean.
No beams drilling into Earth's core.
Right. Yeah. The only beam in this movie drills into Brie Larson and gives her powers in a completely unexciting flashback. The whole core of this character.
What do you mean unexciting?
I mean, I want to see the movie about her relationship with Annette Bening. I want to see the movie about
it is
who
about
she was before. No, yeah, it isn't. It is. It's like telling you that's what it's about, but in materially, it is not about that at all.
But how can it be? Like, if it is about someone dealing with not knowing her past, who's been stripped of memories, who's been abused by these people, and told that she cannot be powerful, that she is the most powerful person in the whole universe, and she's being kept down by specifically Jude Law, this guy who is abusive to her, and she has suffered trauma on top of trauma, not only the physical trauma of that incident, but then the aftermath of being, you know, abused.
But again, these are all objectively things that the movie is doing and it's about, but none of them have any meat on their bones for me because it is all just based on the movie ramming this stuff down your throat. I mean, like they spar in that first scene, which is like directly out of The Matrix, and he essentially yells at her all of the themes of the movie, and that is the extent to which they're ever really explored. It's all hero. Yes, please. Go.
I had to change my baby's diaper in that scene, and I missed it, and I didn't understand a lot of things that happened. So, if I say something that sounds really stupid, I missed it. I didn't see Annette Bening show up as the supreme consciousness or whatever until the very end and did not understand that at all. See the first 5 minutes of Captain Marvel. I don't recommend
it. Don't miss it.
Wait, so Sam's review was that he was so blown away by this movie, he shat his pants.
Pretty much. And really just the Stan Lee tribute Marvel logo was what did it. And,
yeah, we all shit our pants over that. It was just so exciting.
Oh, yeah. Very moving.
I mean, yeah, I think David's big problem here, just to talk about him, even though he's in the room, just like put him over in the corner for a second. It's like a first 15 minutes problem. I get it. They have to lay track. They're blunt about the themes, but like
I felt it. I think the groundwork for it is laid in the first 15 minutes, but the damage is done later on.
But you need that groundwork. You want it to be bluntly stated so that it could be bluntly restated in like a thrilling revelation and a thrilling moment, so she can transform into her costume.
Toss a question to Dave. What's your question for Dave?
My question to Dave is: come on, you're on my side, right?
This is a solid middle ground Marvel movie. It's better than something like Doctor Strange, but not as good as something like Spider-Man Homecoming. And that is because I'm a Marvel fan. But what I've learned from talking to people, who have seen Captain Marvel, those are the people I talk to, the people who haven't seen the movie and want to have an opinion can fuck right off. The people I've talked to who have seen it, it seems like, in terms of superhero representation, Black Panther was delivered to us in a way where I think in our review we talked about like Afrofuturism on screen and how interesting it was to see that in like a blockbuster. Because the Captain Marvel story is about a woman being gaslit, it's the plot, the base plot is coded in there in a way where I don't think if you don't have your hackles up to emotionally receive that plot, which I think is what the Jude Law, Brie Larson fight scene is signaling, is it's basically saying tune into this frequency if you want to get this movie, or just see it as a superhero fight if you're a dude and you'll also enjoy this movie full of superhero fights. So, for somebody who's on that wavelength, it plays as this gaslighting, finding your emotional power, investigating your own history when it feels wrong because you should trust your own emotions in that. I could see how that plays. To me, it read as the best Superman movie that's been released in my lifetime because it's just like a flying American alien who decides to be good, and she gets to go through all of it without like being fucking depressing, which just like was great. I love superheroes that are super strong, that stop missiles and that fly through entire alien ships and that are basically unkillable, but are being held back by their own mental anguish. The problem is you could do that story, with a man, and he has to be like this brooding, bearded, like absentee father asshole that makes you hate the movie he's in. Captain Marvel decided that it was going to be a memory game, which may not work as cleanly as a plot, but doesn't make me hate the superhero that's overpowered because she's actually being held back. She's not holding herself back. So in terms of just superhero tropes, that's why that didn't bother me.
Yeah, it's cool to see her like her power so much and not struggle with like how she should use them. But like the more powerful she gets, the more thrilled she is.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't need to snap Zod's neck and pretend that's like a huge thing in order for us to like get that she's, you know, troubled or whatever.
But the best scenes like are where she actually merges that with her sort of emerging humanity. I mean, there's a period of this movie where she's not even entirely sure if she's human. She thinks she might be Kree. She's bleeding blue out of her nose. But the scenes where she is on Terra Firma talking to, what's the name of the character? Her buddy from
the Maria Rambo's mother, who's also.
Oh, yeah, Rambo. Yeah. Rambo. She's talking to Rambo and her daughter, and they're speaking, with actual emotion and relating to that. Like, and the superhero stuff is sort of under the surface, but, and in the background, but it's, it's a lot more direct than that. Like that, those scenes were affecting. It's where you see the germ of a character for Captain Marvel, but all of that falls to the wayside for me when you get into the story. And I'm so much more interested when the action starts and the lights and the flashing and the running and the dying. I sound like Ian Malcolm. I'm so much more interested in the Skrulls at that point. I really thought that the stuff with Ben Mendelsohn was surprisingly affecting.
What I'm presupposing is that the parts where you felt that drop out, I don't think it dropped out for everybody. I think some people see being in this like impossible situation that is different from her passion, but like sort of parallel because she got forced into it. Like, I think that all reads to a certain audience member. It didn't read to me, but I have heard that from people, so I'm much more forgiving of that part of the story. If you're going to have a everybody superhero, it's going to be part of a blank slate. That's part of the big problem with, like, these big superpowered blank slate ultimate superhero characters. And so that's where I sort of pick up on what Katie said, where maybe this isn't, you know, Brie Larson's performance either isn't fully there or is leaning back on the fact that Brie Larson's sort of naturally charming when she wants to be. I think that's part of the blank superhero slate that's just showing through. But, I mean, I definitely agree with that it's, like, better than Captain America Winter Soldier, which is doing the exact same thing, like leaning too hard on a plot because it has a reveal coming up.
But that movie, which again I don't think is particularly good, has the advantage of an entire movie's worth, well, two movies worth at that point, really, of time with Steve Rogers and like understanding what he's all about and having some sort of soul there, where I think that Captain Marvel, for me anyway, played like a bit of an empty vessel for the emotions that we're told that she's supposed to have and the feelings she's supposed to represent.
I mean, I got emotional during this film and I really wasn't expecting to in a number of ways. I really got into I guess she's going by Vers when she first arrives to Earth.
Veers.
I did not pick up on that being Carol Danvers until the actual reveal. So congratulations to people who wrote the script. Did not see that coming. Veers. And so I was really into her and Nick Fury, like going on this mini 90s adventure. I like when they're infiltrating. I guess it's not S.H.I.E.L.D. I guess it's Pegasus. Anyway, whenever they're looking for files and that kind of stuff. And I like when Fury confronts Talos when he's still bad, and they have their thing. All these like intimate fight scenes. There's really not a whole lot of action in the movie. So it's funny. It's really that first 15 minutes that could make or break the movie for people. And I think it breaks it for a lot of others, but Nick Fury, Sam Jackson knows what he's doing in these movies. He's so goddamn charismatic in the, de-aging stuff. I didn't think about it once until Agent Coulson showed up. He looked like a piece of shit. But
I'm glad we're getting the
grip. All the money went to Sam Jackson's face.
Agent Coulson looks like that, like the bad Jesus mural that the woman made. It's Samuel Jackson looks amazing.
Understand this stuff better than I do. Is it just because there's so much more footage of Samuel Jackson in the mid-90s than there is of Clark Gregg?
I'm pretty sure like they could just paste the negotiator face over Sam Jackson from every angle.
That's what they did.
Agent Coulson.
You want my blood? Take my blood.
Which is good. Coulson, you can't watch the negotiator anymore.
Agent Coulson looks like Lori Loughlin's daughter photoshopped into a crew image.
Leave Lori Loughlin's daughter alone. Yeah. Her life is already ruined.
Hey, she put herself on YouTube. She's a big YouTube star. This is her own problem. Anyway, yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't so have Nick much Fury really for her, worked but... for me. And then Katie, you were just talking about this, the Talos stuff. I mean, did you get emotional over anything? Because the refugee story here really worked for me, and I was shocked. Like, I didn't see it coming, and maybe it's because I harbor Marvel history in my brain, and I just thought that after Thanos was defeated in Endgame that we would have endless Skrull Mishigas to the end of time, and I'm glad I guess we still could, but it would seem like more of a violation with how this movie goes and makes the Skrulls I don't know. Is this an Israel-Palestine situation?
I got that vibe for sure. Sorry, go on.
Oh, I think the only part that I felt like emotional was like the one part of the, you know, the feminist uplift of this that worked for me at the very end, where Lee Pace is talking about how the woman is the weapon at the end. I like that line.
Yeah.
But for me with the Skrulls, that was more surprising is I feel like we've seen so many actors in Marvel movies, like in crazy makeup and playing villainous roles, Lee Pace included, and just who just get totally swallowed by the effects around them. And Ben Mendelsohn is just giving this performance under this pounds and pounds of green makeup. And like, I watched Ready Player One not that long ago, and he's like fine but really serviceable in that, and he's fine but serviceable in Rogue One. And in this, like having him playing like a mean functionary at first and then turning into this character, I was kind of astonished by what he was able to do with this character. And like in the scene where kind of he's like having the turn there in the house in Louisiana, and he and Brie Larson are out standing in a field. And it's another one of those scenes that looks like Bowden and Fleck actually shot it. And it just feels so authentic with him standing there in his weird rubber mask. I was so impressed by him and I guess that makeup team.
Yeah, I was just
saying, one issue.
I'm glad it wasn't CG. For me,
yeah, one issue for me though, I think, is that I hated Infinity War so much and found it like so insufferable that now a movie like this that, you know, the ulterior motive of what they're doing, you know, as they wait in a holding pattern between Infinity War and Endgame, is just trying to put the pieces together and set us up for that, that it's hard for me not to bring over some leftover ill will to anything that's just trying to get me excited for the second part of that. And when my audience cheered at the scene after the credits, which for me, like, I'm not comparing.
You usually leave Marvel movies before that happens. I've seen you walk out before.
I do not. I have not left before a post-credit scene because.
And the actual post-credit scene in this is great.
That's true.
Sure. Yeah. I did, you know, Goose the cat, action. Represent. Good cat. Great surprise. I'm not comparing Marvel fanatics to Trump people. I am just saying. That this, like, chemically, in an objective level, the same part of my brain lights up when people go nuts for an incredibly obvious tease for Endgame as they do when I watch a Trump rally, where I'm like, what are you people smoking?
Wait, what does this have to do with Ben Mendelsohn?
I was just pivoting to why I think my reaction to this movie may have been slightly colored by its place in the overall Marvel universe. Ben Mendelsohn, I think, is representative, if we want to segue back to that, of something a lot more positive. He brings, despite playing an alien character who's under pounds of latex for most of the movie, a real sense of humanity to a movie where the lead character has far too little.
Fair.
By the last act, I was into all the Carol realizes who she is. Carol assumes her position as Captain Marvel. Rah-rah. Hero moments. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Rambo's daughter is picking the colors of the Captain Marvel suit. I just, when she lit up in the blue, red, and gold outfit we knew she'd wear, it's all over the posters, it's iconic from the comics. I got chills, I got emotional during that, especially because the daughter's involved. I thought that was really pretty powerful and really stood in contrast to some dumber stuff.
Can I steal a point made by Angie Han on Twitter about that scene?
Please.
That the movie is her deciding not to fight the wars on behalf of the people that are saying it's right, and she's trying to end war, and it's anti-imperialism specifically. But also it's hand in glove with the Air Force and the U.S. military. And specifically in that scene, she's picking those colors based on the Air Force colors. And it never really reckons with the fact that it's pro-U.S. military, but anti-wars on other planets. It's an interesting point that I didn't think about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Marvel, I think that's an interesting point, especially because this is not the first time that Marvel movies have gotten meshed up with the military. And again, our beloved Captain America First Avenger is the only Marvel movie. You know, Tony Stark is an arms dealer and he reckons with that over the course of his arc. But Captain America First Avenger really grapples with the sort of pro-war nationalism and making weapons for weapons' sake and everything like that. And that character sort of fulfills that role in a way that makes, I don't know,
I don't understand
that Captain Marvel didn't lean on that, because I thought that would be redundant in the overall Marvel universe. I would rather see Captain Marvel be, you know, just what is dig the actual more to the character than the military.
Criticism that she should defy the military, that she shouldn't be.
No, just that the message of the movie is a blanket in favor of the military. Like, it's, how is it's not questioning
she's not
the Air
part
Force.
Of the military.
Well, she's in the Air Force.
She questions
was
the Air Force by being
part of Project Pegasus because they won't let her fly battle missions.
I think it's weird to make that criticism and a little like prying for more problematic arguments to make personally. No offense to our colleague Angie. That is a reach for me because there is a part in the film where, I mean, Carol's finding value in the military, which is a perfectly respectable thing to do. And she mentions that they can't actually fly in war. She signed up for this knowing that she can't be a fighter pilot because at this moment in the 90s, up until very recently, women can't fight in the military like this.
Sure, but that's not the same thing as like pointing some of the questioning of imperialism and wars back on the military that does not
but
get
in the end, she's becoming an individual hero who's making her own decision. She's not part of the U.S. Air Force, and she's not part of the Kree Army, and she is acting on her own volition. Isn't the whole idea that she is no longer part of the military?
Sure, but the Air Force is also using the movie Captain Marvel to recruit people, so I don't think that there's a, you know...
Well, whose fault is that? That's not Carol Danvers' fault.
No, Marvel... I'm talking more about the meta-Marvel message of, like, whether or not they're actually standing behind the messages that are in their movie, and it seems pretty clear that partnering with the military is convenient for them as a studio, and they're willing to kind of... I don't know, like, it's a little hypocritical to call out their fictional army, but not the real one.
If partnering with the military means that conservative a-holes who listen to Tucker Carlson and don't want to see this movie because it's, like, a female forward, go see the movie, then so be it, in my opinion.
I do feel like the less we talk about Marvel trolls, and really any trolls in general, the better... And the healthier
Fine,
the discourse will be. And I also am starting to
anymore,
feel a little bit
David,
cynical.
You're off the podcast.
I know. I'm gone. Much to the delight of our listeners, I'm sure. But I am starting to feel a little bit cynical about some of the most beautiful sentiments that bubble up around these movies. Because I feel like, as we see from the box office, clearly the trolls are not having any sort of real effect. But they are hijacking the conversation around the movie. And they're becoming – like they're being used – to Marvel's benefit as people use them as a rallying cry to go see this movie. And that's great. But I do think that we are always going to be looking at every single blockbuster about a woman as a litmus test for the viability of blockbusters about women, even though they have passed that litmus test 1,000 times over, in much better movies than this, if not more successful. And the fact that we promote these negative voices every time one of these movies comes around and highlight them and write stories about them, and point out
Who's
how
we?
They're
Who's
some
we,
reading.
Exactly?
The media, I mean, IndieWire has tried not to do this with this particular movie, but this
but
is something
failed.
That the whole business latches onto is what is reinforcing the idea that every one of these movies is going to be judged as if it's make or break for the entire notion of centering around blockbuster.
Well, they did release the movie on International Women's Day. So there
you
go.
Yeah. I mean, hear me Great. Rolling my eyes.
I don't you think, well, I mean, Marvel, as you said, Marvel leans into this stuff and it tries to.
But
leverage.
Yeah, no, but just my greater point is just that I think that we are if we could somehow isolate the positive sentiment, the feeling of celebration for those who feel it.
Fine. Dave cut all of David's comments about the movie out.
I was
going to
say
my positive.
I love the feeling behind what you're saying, but I also am of the feeling that when people are wrong about something they haven't seen, it's my job to drag them in the public square and step on their neck.
Oh yeah, I had
like
forgotten that
Steel?
you had made a whole spectacle of this. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel
if the critics who are having the thoughtful conversation can't be the arbiters. I would also like to make clear I'm not writing posts or anything that make money off of this. This is literally what I do to entertain myself. I'm just saying if that's
clearly
like,
yes.
I don't think there's a bad part. If we are going to talk about the trolls before the movie's released, then I definitely think we have to talk about how wrong and dumb they were after the movie was released.
Of course they're dumb. I mean, it's the movie doesn't change the fact that they're dumb. The movie could make $0 and they'd still be dumb. I mean, they're hateful creatures, and the world has spun past them, but we act as if we haven't every time. We act as if it's still a battle in flux rather than acting as though we've already won.
You are the one talking about them now, though.
But I'm with you, David.
Well, talking about them in the service of not talking about them again.
In what I think is a healthy skepticism of the studio that is trying to become the one lasting studio, I think noticing that they are using trolls who are really insignificant and who are fighting a battle that's already been won as a way to say, buy a ticket to our movie, and that means you support feminism. It's worth raising your eye at that,
even though
there's a lot of genuine enthusiasm.
I think it goes back to our Netflix, conversation where Netflix was like, we're in favor of all film. And I was like, dude, no one was saying you weren't in favor of all film. You don't have to step out and say this as a company.
I believe they use the word cinema.
Cinema. Anyway, Captain Marvel.
We should end on... Yeah, here's a positive note to end on. Katie, what do you think of Annette Bening?
Oh, man. When, in the part of the beginning of the movie that I did see, where, the second shot is Annette Bening holding a gun, I was like, oh my God. This movie rules.
That's fan service.
It gave you something you didn't realize you'd always wanted.
Yeah. Pretty much. I hadn't really given that much thought to how much she was in the movie. And I feel like she is much better used by this than, Glenn Close in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh my God.
And same with, Jude Law. They did a lot with their high profile.
Wait, Oscar loser Glenn Close was in Guardians of the Galaxy?
Wait.
Completely forgot.
Cinnamon bun hair, dude.
Don't you guys want Captain Marvel 2 to be those two on each side of the war? Annette Bening versus Glenn Close?
Oh, she
Are
won't
they
be
on
dead.
Separate sides of the...
Yes,
I don't remember.
So Glenn Close talks to the Supreme Intelligence through an ambassador in Guardians of the Galaxy. Otherwise, it could have been Annette Bening and Glenn Close right from the beginning. But the Supreme Intelligence is definitely still around at that point.
Whoa.
Holy crap. Yeah, is Glenn Close still alive in the Guardians universe?
She would be if it was another prequel sequel.
Correct, which it would have to be because all of Xandar was destroyed off-screen before Infinity War.
Thanks, Thanos. Well, they could undo it all, Dave.
They could undo it all, or they could just launch Nova directly out of it. Lots of stuff could happen.
No, you mean Chris Klein's character from American Pie?
Yes, exactly.
I can't tell you guys how mad I was when the Tesseract emerged as a part of this movie because I don't remember what it was, and it was there, and it became before the rings for the Infinity Gauntlet. No, stones for the Infinity Gauntlet, and I was so pissed.
I'm just so glad that you have to know some of these. You possess this knowledge now.
And that I have resisted, but yet it's just there somehow.
It's the Tesseract from that movie.
You still called them rings, so we're not all the way there.
God.
I mean, they go on his fingers. It's not that far.
No, that's true. You're close. You're pre-sonicking. We'll get there.
Is the Tesseract... I'm going to regret asking this.
Oh,
does the Tesseract have anything to do with Infinity Stones?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Just that's all.
I think I know the answer to this. The Tesseract is an Infinity Stone.
Correct. No, the Tesseract has one in the center. Stone. Inside of it is the Soul Stone. Or in the is
21 movies.
Stone.
You'd think I know by now. But
is it really 21?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
22nd movie in a month.
All of them. Jesus Christ.
I can't wait to gather back on this podcast and talk about the 22nd Marvel movie, yes, coming out in 1 month's time.
Hooray for corporations.
Based on my track
record, I love to get together
with,
and celebrate the one movie studio that is shutting out all others.
Based on my track record with Infinity War, I will see Endgame in 6 months, so don't worry.
You'll see Endgame when we're all talking about Star Wars.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. I guess we can go ahead and say it's going to be the quarter quell, right?
Finally.
It's going to happen.
We're doing it. What do you mean finally?
No more.
Right on time.
This is exactly the number that we were supposed to hit. So tune in for that. Those are always especially good episodes. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm a senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, share them with friends, and leave your Captain Marvel thoughts. Get the conversation started at fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on iTunes, where you should leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way to help our podcast find new listeners. I will read, for the first time live and on camera, literally anything that you write, put that to the test on iTunes.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on another podcast called Storm of Spoilers, where we talked about Captain Marvel last week. And I'm back at Thrillist.com for your Marvel and Game of Thrones needs this summer. Check me out there.
And I'm Katie Rich. I'm still not quite back on VF.com, but I am on Little Gold Men over there, where I'll be talking to Joanna Robinson about South by Southwest this week. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H, and we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you can yell at us about Captain Marvel or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Captive State, what cinematic alien or fantasy society would you most like to live in?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you for the Quarterquel next week. I'm